Welcome to The Brainstorm, episode 98. Very close. Today, we're talking about browsers. Are they worth $30 billions of dollars? And stablecoins. Everyone launching L1s. Where do we want to start, Brett? Stablecoins or Perplexity browser?
Maybe we'll start with stable. Well, it's not stablecoins. It's launching L1s combined with stablecoins. But why don't we start with that topic where Circle, which you know, has created USDC, the stablecoin. It's a synthetic dollar that people can use to kind of like do blockchain stuff, but with US dollars, has announced it's launching a level one blockchain to support its stablecoin. And so this is Ethereum is a level one blockchain. Bitcoin is a level one blockchain. Solana is a level one blockchain. This is a separate blockchain for specifically designed, and it's called ARC, not spelled like our ARC, to support stablecoins. And Nick, do you think it's going to work?
It's a great question. I don't think I am the expert to be able to answer this. In listening to the crypto team on Friday talk about it, it does seem that, you know, part of this is just being able to have more control or allowing their partners to potentially have more control. As in, if you want to onboard banks in a serious way to the stablecoin environment, pitching them a layer two on top of Ethereum, you're probably losing some people. And the banks can just say to themselves, well, we'll just build a consortium a la the Zelle method to Venmo and do this without you. And so I do think part of this is looking down the road, seeing where stablecoins are headed. If you want to get, you know, real institutional adoption from the JP Morgans of the world, I think you have to offer them something that currently isn't in the pitch. And that is, you know, you have a say in potentially what happens.
Here's my thing. It's I think every crypto cycle you have, you know, people are like, oh, that's a thing. We can do that thing. And we'll just do it in the corporate way. So there I feel like I've had 25 debates over the years about private blockchains and whether or not they're useful. And typically people from traditional business have said, yes, there should be we'll do Bitcoin, but we're going to do it in a database on our computer. And it's like, well, then you have a database. And if you decentralize it, you have an expensive database, but still a database. And this feels similar in that, what is the point of calling it a blockchain if it's just going to be JP Morgan and Bank of America that are kind of like validating this thing? Like, why even bother with the fiction that it's some kind of blockchain?
Mm-hmm. Well, the question is, who is asking for it to be a blockchain? And I ask myself this question all the time, which is, do I actually care if it's decentralized or not? Or better, because I'm not, you know, everyone, does the next, you know, hundreds of millions of people that onboard into the crypto space truly care at the end of the day when they go to rest their head on the pillow that their money that was moved from point A to point B was done so in a decentralized way? Or do they care that it got from point A to point B seamlessly and with convenience? And I think it's the latter. And so I do think this is going to continue to become an issue. And we've talked about it, right? We've been talking about it for 7 years since I've been at ARK, like this tug of war between centralization and decentralization. And I do think stablecoins in a way put that, you know, at the forefront of the conversation.
Well, Brett, let me jump in quickly here. It's like, I agree with what you've said, and I think I am on the same side where it's like, okay, this again. But the difference this time is that it's like this cycle is the institutional cycle. So it's like, if it were to ever happen, it seems like it would be now, because it's like retail's not even involved in this conversation for the most part. And so if it is the big institutions that are finally adopting it, you know, they could have that say. At the same time, you know, to speak against myself here, is it's like they've all already onboarded and it's the way it is. So it's like, why change it?
It's also a centralized money, right? Stablecoins are USD wrapped in digital form. So it doesn't, you know, it's not far-fetched to say that.
Yeah. The argument for, well, yeah, what does this kind of matter is that Circle can already blacklist coins. Like, you can already, even though it's on a decentralized ledger, even though it clears and settles to Ethereum, before you get there, if they will like knock somebody off for money laundering or whatever. So it's already a controlled gated system where Circle, at the behest of the US regulator, is operating as this central gatekeeper. And I think that there is having something that can operate along other things, other smart contracts, kind of natively on that chain, I think just provides more developer optionality. And so you can imagine the banks not wanting, you know, a smart contract that is directly competitive with them, or that they claim is going to be systemically dangerous to the financial institutions, but really it's systemically dangerous to their profit centers, will mean that kind of this this consortium will restrict the utility of this underlying chain, maybe in a way that causes, not immediately, but down the road, people to be like, oh, well, I can't do that thing that I kind of want to do if I'm in this space. And so therefore I'm going to live in this other space.
Wait, so do you think,
can you elaborate?
So does that mean, do you think there's a chance that using a layer one now could be a local maximum? Is that what you were just saying? Where it's like, oh, great, you got it. But then it actually doesn't do the promise. And someone who didn't opt for a layer one, it's like 3 years from now, next cycle, has far more freedom because they didn't lock in to this framework.
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying, but I'll interpret it. Okay. are you saying a banking? I'm saying these banks set up a layer one, and then there's some kind of like set of USDCs that is like clearing and settling on this layer one. Mm-hmm. They can be bridged across into kind of like the Ethereum layer. But for the ones clearing and settling in this layer one, basically you won't be able to have those dollars operate with certain smart contracts and stuff, I think. And so the tangible example, Nick, that I think you're trying to ask for, or one that obviously they won't allow, that you could do in Ethereum, is an asset mixer. As in, imagine I have USDC and I want to kind of conceal what I'm doing with them. And so I like put it into a pool where it gets mixed up in a bunch of different ways. And so you can't tell kind of like the inbounds and the outbounds. And for anti-money laundering reasons, banks wouldn't allow that contract to exist on their layer one. Those contracts exist in Ethereum land. I don't know what happens to your USDC if you shove one through a contract. If Circle turns around and says, okay, we have to like blacklist this because you're not allowed to do that. So this may be a specious example, but there is, maybe some kind of lending operations or, you know, things that are a little more ambiguously kind of, you know, in the gray area where banks clearly want to preserve some of their profit function. They'll prevent developers from developing to that platform or launching apps to that platform.
Yeah, Brett, that's what I wanted you to elaborate on, was just the idea around the profit center and why banks might be just inherently against the current form of stablecoins. And I messaged you last week, you know, if you think about the one-to-one nature of a stablecoin versus the fractional reserve functionality of a bank, like they're inherently at odds with each other. Yeah. And yeah, maybe I want to leave that there because you then responded to me and then subtweeted me on Twitter, which is fine. It's okay. But I wanted you to bring it to the people. And because I said, well, you know, stablecoins might inherently be bad for the economy if you think about it from that lens, and you can explain why and why it's actually not the case. Because you.
Well, right. So the idea is, you put a dollar in the banking system, you think that dollar still stays there. It's in the banking system. No. No, the bank lends it out to somebody and that person redeposits it in the banking system. And so they magically create more money that's out there than is kind of deposited. And so they can, you know, run 10-to-1 reserve to deposit, meaning that kind of if everybody tried to withdraw their money at once, only 10% of the money would come out and they'd be like, oh, sorry, we're done. They'd have to call in loans. It creates a huge mess. And so if you imagine I'm taking a dollar from the bank and I'm going into stablecoin land for the registered stablecoins.
Right. You're halting leverage.
Yes. The dollar they have in has to be backed by treasuries on the back end. There's no multiplication factor. And so you could make a very simple case. Well, I take a dollar out of the banking system, put it in stablecoin. Therefore, the amount of loans outstanding has to shrink. And so it's bad for the economy because they can't lend out as much money. But it's kind of like when you put a dollar into stablecoin land, it's buying treasuries, which then pushes down the treasury curve, which then means that the treasury system, it doesn't exactly work like this, but will basically push more money or liquidity into the system. And so, and anything that is, you know, where people are borrowing based upon kind of the yield curve, kind of their cost to borrow will get pushed down. So I think there's this countervailing factor that happens, and it just means that rather than using bank balance sheets to lend, we'll use more capital markets type instruments to lend.
And you think that's actually equal? You think those are equal in magnitude to some extent?
I think they basically offset. Yes.
But does it change the distribution of capital and lending, right?
Yes.
As in like, yeah, maybe that's where.
Yes. And that's why banks hate it, is because like banks need to lend. Like that's part of their business is taking money and lending money. And what I think at a very high level, what's going to happen with crypto assets and smart contracts is just more credit creation is going to happen through financialized channels. Like as in right now, if I wanted to issue a bond offering, I couldn't do it. I'm too small, right? I have to be of a certain size to afford to hire the underwriters to then go and sell it to people. And so it's not something that could trade in the market. There's not enough liquidity. But in a future, like, you know, the world is all in digital asset space, you know, little businesses could actually issue bonds that then trade in their local markets. And everything becomes more market intermediated rather than bank intermediated. And at a high level, I think that's good. It's like no longer is credit being offered to the guy who has a good golf game that the banker golfs with. Instead, it's like, just on the metrics that are visible and provable in the market is the cost to borrow for these enterprises and businesses. And, you know, we're a long way from there. But
speaking of places we're a long way away from, it seems like at some point in the future, stable coins are not going to be stable. It's like right now, this is like the ultimate question. People are like, they have to be pegged one-to-one, you know, Tether. They were just on a podcast you can see on ARK's YouTube where they said, right, I think it's like 80% in treasuries, but then there's also a ton of gold and some Bitcoin holdings as well. It seems like the way this goes is that once everyone accepts them as stable, then we start to venture into the, oh, well, it's kind of like a bank and, you know, it's stable enough that everyone who wants money can get it at this point in time. Do you think that's a natural evolution here for these entities or no?
Well, yes. I think that there is always like a, this is what you're allowed to do by regulators. And they try to make it so you do something that doesn't have any risk. But then by taking marginally more risk, you can actually make more money. And particularly if it's a regulatory threshold, then you'll figure out ways to maximize risk in your thing that's supposed to be stable, that to regulators or to the market does not appear like it's like that risky or it fits within the framework of the rules. And that's the like global financial crisis. It's basically, you know, this thing that was worth a dollar the asterisk becomes very large. It's no longer worth a dollar. Everybody realizes it all at once. You run on the bank. I don't know. I think there's probably going to be a financial systemic event that revolves around stable coins in some way. I would argue it's more likely to happen in the banks are trying to launch deposit coins, right? Which are like stable coins, but they offer you the same great benefits of getting interest paid on your deposits in the bank. And they're lending against them.
0.01% APR.
Yeah. And so to me, that seems like a necessarily riskier thing. If you have stable coins backed by treasuries or even backed by 90% treasuries, you have to have a lot of outflow to come under stress. If you have a deposit that has $10 of loans stacked on top of the $1 in deposit, and you say, hey, we're going to make this deposit easier to move around. Right. And in fact, we're going to expose it to like AI agents can move it around for you. And they might sniff out that the bank has a loan out to some company that if they call the loan, that company will go bankrupt. And so then you like pull the deposit coin out and short the company and you like cause a collapse. I just think it's inevitable that when you have like financial innovation happens, leverage builds up in an unexpected place and it kind of all unravels. I think synthetic dollars is at some point that will happen. I don't know if it'll be on these current like set of assets.
Okay, so let's wrap this up in a coherent way. I think that last point is important. So maybe we'll start there. One, bank deposit coins likely far riskier than they sound relative to a stable coin. Maybe two, stable coins, incredibly useful institutional adoption here, even though it's like retail's very aligned with stable coins, I would say, but it's finally entering the institutional world. Three, the one where I still have the biggest question mark, so maybe one of you can put a succinct answer here. Layer ones for these companies, right? It's not just Circle. Stripe has explored this. There are other companies that are doing this. Fad or future?
I think these systems tend towards kind of like seeking most liquidity and kind of like breadthiest platform. And so I think that the utility they get out, I just think that they will wither during a crypto winter. I can't imagine, it's hard for me to envision a world in which there are, you know, a huge number of layer ones. And I don't have that opinion super strongly, as in once Ethereum went to proof of stake, it's kind of like you can figment these things into existence with no backing at all. And that's the underlying concern I have, is like proof of stake has always seemed like a snake eating its own tail to me. So why not just have JP Morgan eat Bank of America's tail and do it that way? You know, and so I think I'm heavily convinced that there will be one proof of work blockchain that, you know, sustainably works in the world. That's Bitcoin. There'll be another on Mars. And then I don't know, like, if you could have like a lot of these level ones that have alternative mechanisms that survive.
All right. So the succinct answer, Brett's still bearish on proof of stake.
Yes. That's what we get to, like, just a fundamental discomfort with everything that's not proof of work for me. Yeah.
All right. So then, Nick, let's throw it over to you for the next topic here. How much is a browser worth?
Depends on who's buying. No, it's a great question given the, call it, unsolicited bid by Perplexity for Google Chrome. And that bid came in at around $34.5 billion. Perplexity is an upstart working on their own generative AI search platform. They've also built their own browser called Comet that focuses on agentic capability. And then the background here is you have Google going through antitrust cases. And part of that is the potential breakup of Chrome as a browser from Google's corporate structure, as in Google, and or I should say Alphabet, will have to sell Chrome to potentially the highest bidder, which as it currently stands happens to be Perplexity, as they're the only ones in the market. But if you look at the bid itself, $34.5 billion, let's put some numbers to it, because okay, that seems like a fair amount of money until you start to work in, you know, how big Chrome is and what it means to the overall market. Chrome itself is around 65% of the browser market globally. It has around 3.5 billion users. So you're talking about, call it, what is that, half of the global population, and much more ex-China, if you think of them not penetrated there at all. So pretty meaningful, browser. And, you know, why is it so important to Google? Well, it's their, you know, front end to search. When you're using Chrome, you're really just, I think, trying to get to Google search. And this brings in the other number that I think is really important to the equation, which is how much Google or Alphabet pays Apple to be the default search engine for Safari, which is the second largest browser and actually the number one browser in the US on mobile because of iOS's outsized penetration in the US. So Safari is around 50% of the total browser market for the mobile space in the US, which, you know, is why Google is paying them anywhere from $18 to $20 billion a year to keep search as the default search engine. So if you think about these numbers, the Perplexity bid at 34.5, and I will, you know, give credit to the source here, because these were numbers that someone else actually did for us. This is around $9 per year per user versus I think it's 20-ish dollars if you look at, you know, what Google is paying to Apple. And then I think the question is, you know, which one of these numbers is right, or is Perplexity, you know, if you're making a bid, obviously you want to add value for yourself. So they're coming in probably at the low end of what they could possibly think is acceptable. But I think in reality, what Google values Chrome at is significantly higher than what anyone else is going to value it at, because they're tying it in to the rest of their products. You know, you have G Suite, everything, Gmail, Docs, Drive, all of that tied very neatly into Chrome. And then it's, you know, the front end gate into the internet and for search. So the price is going to vary depending on the bidder and how they can build it or integrate it into their current offering. But I think for Perplexity, they look at this as distribution. And this, you know, Brett, you and I, we've had this conversation time and time again. You know, how important is distribution in this race that we're seeing, this AI arms race? And I think for a company like Perplexity, which is wrapping itself around the model providers, so Perplexity is not building their own model, or they're fine tuning other models provided by OpenAI, Anthropic, Google, you know, being able to bring in more users than these model providers have themselves that are going direct to OpenAI, direct to Anthropic, direct to Gemini, is extremely important to their value proposition in the market. So they need to tip the scales in their favor, and that will bring them, you know, importance in this AI space.
Well, that here's a question. Oh, can I just on that front? This is like, it's important for Perplexity because Perplexity is small, but like someone like OpenAI, if they started OpenAI browser and then just directed all searches through their own browser, it's like, do they need a browser for, is a browser just distribution? What makes, it's like, you know, when Chrome took over, we discussed this in Brainstorm. It's like, why did people switch to Chrome? How did it get so big? What can a browser offer someone today that doesn't exist or that's orthogonal? Because to me, right, it's like everyone's trying to start their own browser. And so
I think, I use Comet from Perplexity and have only just kind of switched over to using it. And I still kind of like am back and forth with Chrome and for various reasons, but it definitely does change your relationship with the browser in kind of a subtle way. As in, even if your default is to use the top bar for an LLM query, as opposed to a Google search, then you actually type something different in. And so it gets you more used to that as being, I mean, I've all the way switched over to that being my go-to source. But it does, I think, change your relationship with kind of that initial query, and you can see how it could change your relationship with the entire internet, with the entire, like, once you have your calendars locked in, it's like, oh, when's my next meeting? You can see how it'll change people's kind of relationship with the underlying apps that are being provided, that are ultimately, you know, these companies' ambition will be to abstract them away. It's like, it shouldn't, you know, imagine a future in which you're not stuck on Gmail because you could just tell it, like, I'm sick of Gmail, switch me to this other one. And it'll like go through this process to like switch you over. You would never do it yourself because, It would be a huge, maybe Gmail is like, Gmail is really hard to extricate.
I was going
to
say,
even a calendar function, but
I'm so skeptical on that. It's like, I always come back to this. It's like AI is going to be so powerful that switching costs go to zero. But it's like, I find
potentially.
That potentially, I'm skeptical on that front.
I agree, Sam. I think there's significant lock-in value to the current, you know, ecosystems that some of these companies, Google specifically, have built. If you do get to a world that, and you know, the product Brett just described, where you can just port yourself over from, you know, Gmail to, I don't know, OpenAI mail, that's a big if. And if that does happen, that erodes significant moat in the current, you know, way.
But it could be not that you port yourself over, but you don't, like, being a Gmail user, you're kind of stuck with their user interface, mm-hmm. right? And there's no way to, and kind of like what the AI models are providing is basically a user interface on top of that, that then deals with the bad user interface decisions they've made for you. You can even send out an agent to navigate through it.
But I don't think what people are going back to for Gmail is the user interface at this point. Given how long,
of course not. That's what I'm saying. It's bad.
It's bad, but it has become part of, you know, it's like a big component of your digital identity. And so to replace that is really hard when you have who knows how many, you know, accounts signed up through your Gmail. So like then having to go to every website and then figure out, oh, what account did I, like, that's where it becomes extremely difficult. And that's where the lock-in value. But Sam, I want to get back to your question around the browser itself. Because as important as the browser is, I think there is a window that comes before it, which is the operating system itself. You know, no one has been able to directly embed these agents and AI, I think, in a meaningful way into the operating system. Google is trying with Android. Apple is clearly fumbling the bag. But
Apple is clearly trying with iOS.
Yeah, Apple is not trying. But that's the first window, right? And so why is the browser important? Because it's your second window to access the internet, right? The first window is your operating system, right? I log into my computer. First thing I'm seeing is the world that Apple has built for me. Then the second is I click into Chrome. Now I'm able to access the internet. At both of those stages, those companies, and really only those companies, have the chance to embed whatever AI they want. And so that is extremely important to this whole question of who wins and why do they win? Because until that changes, those companies, in my opinion, are inherently driving or have a better strategic position than a company like Perplexity or OpenAI. Not that they don't have a chance, they're doing everything they can. And the more time that goes on that Apple continues to sit on their hands or Google doesn't roll out Gemini in the correct way and they continue to amass user, that's how the leverage in the system swings towards these, you know, newer players.
I mean, I do think the browser as a second window is a good or an interesting framing. And like the browser is in some ways strategically more important than the operating system in that it is shared across. And we're probably all on Mac entire ecosystem, so it kind of conflates the two. But if you're, you know, if you're on Android and then whatever else, kind of the browser is shared across the assets, right? And so, and it can live independent of the assets. Like, I think that there's another point that's important, which is that if you own the browser, you also own the user actions, the data on the user actions as they go through it. So, you know, there's this whole battle going on of like, do agents have to pay to access the data on sites on behalf of users? And there's stuff you can get from web scraping, but you can't actually get the you know, what is the user flow going through a website? If you have the browser itself, then for these companies that want to kind of like train agentic systems, then they can get the client side interactions to then further train their models. So that's why it's an important strategic piece for OpenAI and Perplexity.
Is it, I don't know, this is going to be, maybe it's like the bundling, unbundling. We've spoken about this before to some extent, like just browser as operating system. Is that a potential future here? Because
you could argue the browser is already an operating system for Google. Yeah. It's like an operating system for
It's like I'm even imagining it's like, let's say AI continues down its path where it's increasingly just going via APIs to backend systems. It's like, okay, what is an app? An app is a company's effort to create a UI for the masses. But if you have a good AI that can do a dashboard N of one for you, it's like, why do you want an app store? Period. It's like, you just want interface with APIs. And it seems like that comes through not an app, but through the browser or through a single app, which would be the AI.
Or through the, but through the, like the reason the browser is powerful is it basically, because everybody has to service to the browser, to people trafficking on browsers.
Right.
If you have a virtual browser window, you could pretend you're a user and, you know, potentially they can't tell. And so you can access any piece of data that belongs to the user or application or anything. And so I do think that there's a, like, I think AI is going to work better working directly on code rather than working inside Excel on behalf of users, because it's like, and same, I think AI that operates through the browser will just be more functional than an AI that you're trying to train to use individual apps, which is like a little more kind of like, you know, idiosyncratic and compressed rather than like a shared data layer.
I think our definition of what a browser is going to change. As in, I think OpenAI and Perplexity or just chatbots themselves already display functionality you tied to a browser, but you're doing less browsing and you're getting more, like it's separating the signal from the noise. Like you know, the use case is in the name, browsing, okay. Right? Yeah. You're spending time trying to figure out what you're trying to ultimately get to. And instead what AI does is just takes browsing out of it and gives you the answer that you're
seeking. Yes, Nick, you've arrived at like totally the right answer. The browser is actually the OpenAI application I have on my desktop and on my phone.
And like it's changing.
Perplexity's trying to lowball bid for like a asset that's going to decay no matter what.
Right. Wait, so this goes back to the original question.
I don't know if
that wait, this is good. This goes back to the original question.
That's not exactly what I meant.
That's exactly what you said, yes.
Okay, but okay, sure. Distribution is super important. At the same time, let's go out 6 years and say, does Chrome have greater or less market share than today?
Well, how are you defining market share? You're defining market share amongst Chrome, Safari, and any browsers that appear?
Yeah. It's like distribution's important, so Chrome's important. But at the same time, if I listen to the conversation we just had, it's like, it's important, but only if you do something with it. And it's like, there's more potential.
Define it as share of attention time or share of transactions, Chrome will be lower and much lower because the activity is going to happen away from the browser. And defined as like, I think AI agents will be spinning up virtual browsers and they won't necessarily be like Chrome instantiations and using those to navigate around the open web. And so if you're including kind of like share of AI use of browsers, I think Chrome will also be lower. But I think the more important like way to think about it is like the browser is the general purpose tool by which we access stuff on the internet right now. And then the apps are like the more convenient tool if somebody has packaged the stuff into an app. Mm-hmm. But like we're not going to spend as much time browsing around the internet to find stuff. Like why bury ourselves in our... So my kid bought a Lego with his hard-earned allowance. And it had a block in it that was supposed to light up, and it did not light up. Very distressing. Very distressing. Now I have to find the replacement block. I didn't find the replacement block. I asked OpenAI's agent to go and like just fix this for me. So it browses around. It took like an hour to like figure out its way through the Lego site to ask for the to send the like customer support thing, the email to ask for the replacement block. And then I was like, also show me, like, give me a site that sells this thing. And then it browsed around for a while. It came back with like the link where I could click in and buy the block. Okay. So that avoided probably half an hour of browsing time for me. And it took like 2 hours. It'll get better. And then I just spent less time doing that stupid task. That's where we're going.
I agree with Brett that I think the time spent in browsers will go down significantly because we're browsing less and we're getting more information value out of AI. But I think Chrome itself can do phenomenally well, continuing to keep its market share, potentially gaining a few more percentages if they tackle, you know, integrating Gemini into Chrome in the right way, which is a very hard and, you know, important gamble that they need to make.
Right. I mean, this is, you know, we always focus on disruption. To me, this feels like the most classic form of disruption in a while, in that it's like clearly it's difficult for them to do it because it's their core business and switching it would do so. And it's like very clearly there's an orthogonal, you know, Brett's use case, which is suboptimal in Google land, but way better for Brett, that can start to eat a ton of share. It's like, what browser did it use to do all of the searching?
Right.
I don't,
I actually don't know. I don't know how it works on the back end for OpenAI, but it's in a server somewhere and it's not a user using it.
Right.
And Google would argue, well, you know, search, we deliver search results with AI and that monetizes just as well as cost per click. But it certainly doesn't do a lot for their partners on the back end who aren't getting the search traffic anymore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's, I think we're in an interesting spot where the companies are beginning, the companies that are search dependent are beginning to report out, hey, we have, you know, basically referral traffic falling off a cliff here because nobody's going to our websites anymore. That has to blow back on Google, doesn't it? As in, suddenly they don't have the money to spend to try to attract that traffic. And so there's going to be sets of keywords that are just less valuable, I think.
Well, I think it comes down to, are the publishing sites that are seeing this referral traffic drop off, are they of information value or commercial value? As in, I think where you're seeing the biggest drop-offs are on informational sites, which really don't monetize well on Google, or those queries just don't monetize well. And that's really where I think AI has, you know, become a, you know, powerhouse in search, is these informational queries. You know, what is X, Y, and Z? Well, in reality, those are not very commercial queries in terms of, you know, click-through rate, being able to monetize keywords within that. For Google itself, now if you get into the camp of travel and some of these very commercial search, like as we get more agentic, then it becomes a problem. Right. Yeah. Then it becomes a real problem.
Yes.
But knowing how to use Lego bricks versus like asking what's the next Lego pack to come out, that's a huge difference in the information or the value.
But Brett, even like to what you were, your example, it's like, is it correct or incorrect that the world and browsers in general still run on Google PageRank? Or do you think that's not true? Like, has OpenAI usurped PageRank to find, you like search Google brick, Lego brick? How does it find it is the question. Is it going to...
Oh. What are they doing in terms of their search?
Exactly.
So Perplexity will say they run their own index and that they don't focus on breadth, but they focus on like top rank depth, as in they're not paying for somebody else's kind of search. I don't know if OpenAI might be calling Bing's API search API, mm-hmm. right? And so then it's just shoving. So they're paying some outbound money to call the API. But I think monetization rate is probably higher margin, but not the same as monetization rate for the core search. So, and you know, if Bing can get any economic market share against Google, that's like a huge win for them because they have 0% share or 1%, 1%, you know,
a share,
A share. They have A share. And I think that you're right, Nick, that like until it starts hitting commercial queries, it's not really going to threaten Google's business. But the AI guys haven't closed the loop on commerce in at least a native way that I've seen that works very well yet. As in,
yeah.
I don't, you know, and once they do, then it becomes really interesting because I'm not going to Wirecutter anymore to say like, what's the best vacuum, right? I definitely ask ChatGPT and it gives me like the list and I'm like, okay. And then I have to click through a link to do the transaction. Once that can all live in that thing, then it really, you know, starts cutting into the commercial sites, the merchants, rather than just the information merchants.
Right. All right. And who better to disrupt Google than Google itself? And I'll end with this. If you think about agentic and commercial, one big category is travel, flight specifically. Everyone that's watching it, I don't think it'll be live yet, but everyone, including both of you, I don't think I've talked to either of you about this, but you should go look at Google's new product. It's called Flight Deals, and it's generative search for flights. So it's, you know, you instead of toggling between, you know, New York airports and then flying to St. Petersburg, and it gives you a list of flights by, you know, cheapest to most expensive. It's, I want to go spend a weekend holiday in X, Y, and Z. And then it goes out and scans the universe, ties in like a whole itinerary of travel. And that I think is really cool. But then it's like, okay, who's doing it? Google.
All right. Yeah. So to sum it up, we'll put a button in this one as well. The way the user interface matters a lot, and it's going to change dramatically with the browser potentially taking center role. Are we comfortable with that assertion?
Yes. I think it's just even fascinating to think about the fact that a browser is a pretty simple piece of software. Chrome is 65% of the market just on being like marginally less frictionful to start out with and having Google layered in. And now, you know, given the, like, I know Perplexly bid 34, it's probably worth $400 to $600 billion just on kind of being the at market early with the software that worked really well for people, causing them to bail out of Internet Explorer into Chrome. And so I think that the actual button in this is the browser is, it's a stepping stone to what some, it's, we're not going to call it a browser anymore. And maybe it's just the AI chatbot. And kind of like the evidence right now is there's like the slickest, most user acquisitive design is ChatGPT. And it's still growing hand over fist. And I think that whatever they do with that distribution is in some ways going to define the category.
See. There it is. Episode 98. I've heard more Nick, you are right on this episode than ever before. So
I don't like it. Chrome is going to decay and die. It's not good. We need to be, butting heads, Brett, for the conversation to move forward. That's how we get to the true insights. If we're on the same page, that means we're at the top of the market. Like that's a bare indication. If we start agreeing on things, that means we're at peak valuations.
Okay. All right. So not investment advice.
That's right.
Log on to Chrome, keep them alive. We'll see everyone next week.
ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. ARK and Public are unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to either firm marketing or selling the products or services of the other. And therefore, ARK disclaims responsibility for any loss that may be incurred by Public's clients or customers. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and/or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in the show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.